The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Not so long ago, when journalists and political operatives use Rolodexes, Fergus Cullen's name was in all of them. The former chairman of New Hampshire's Republican Party was one of the go-to people for a quick read or quote on the First in the Nation primary. Well, politics has changed since then. The state's primary is now a national battleground, with outside interest groups and PACs spending millions to target voters. But even in an election, when anyone with a Twitter handle can command the stage, Fergus Cullen remains a go-to guy with a canny institutional memory. Well, today we're mining stories of primaries past from his book, Granite Steps, Stumbles, Surprises, and Successes Along the New Hampshire Primary Trail. Fergus Cullen, thank you so much for joining us.
That was a very generous introduction.
Oh,
thank
you. Well, you know, I grew up in New Hampshire, too, and it's sort of like growing up an Eskimo around snow. You know, it's always there. When did you first become aware of the primary and what it meant in national politics?
Boy, 1988, I was a sophomore at Guilford, New Hampshire High School, and it was an open seat that year. I went around to see Republicans, Democrats, wherever they were. I had my driver's license and went around with some buddies, and ever since, I've been hooked on the New Hampshire primary.
Well, Granite Steps, this covers six presidential primaries from 1992 to 2012, years when Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama were elected presidents, but not victorious in the New Hampshire contest. So this begs the question whether the state's claim, always first, always right, still applies.
Yeah, that was the watch phrase of the primary for its first several decades until Bill Clinton lost in New Hampshire. You know, he called himself the comeback kid. People tend to forget sometimes that Paul Tsongas was, in fact, the strong winner that night. But he became president, and ever since, it hasn't had the same stake in terms of always first, always right. But a win here or performing well still matters. It is still a level playing field where all candidates, regardless of their name recognition or financial resources, get an equal opportunity to succeed. Now, they don't all succeed. In fact, most of them do fail, but they all go home defeated or otherwise and say, you know, I had my shot and New Hampshire is what gave me that chance.
Well, it's funny that you identify Bill Clinton as an outsider. He's an insurgent back in 92.
Yeah, you know, back in 1992, Democrats had lost 5 out of 6 of the previous presidential elections, and Bill Clinton started his campaign saying, we need to change as Democrats. If we nominate another unelectable liberal in the model of Walter Mondale or Michael Dukakis, we're going to lose. And that was his strong new Democratic message. Now, it all got swallowed up in questions of character that all happened here in New Hampshire. When the Jennifer Flowers story broke, Bill Clinton was in New Hampshire in Nashua that day talking on a senior citizens forum. When the draft letter broke, he was here in New Hampshire that day as well. Everything that happened to Bill Clinton happened in New Hampshire, and the voters here were thrust into the role of jury.
Well, it's so interesting because if in the national media, this spelled the end for his campaign, those two revelations. How did New Hampshire voters react, and how does that distinguish them?
Well, he survived here, and he showed his tremendous resilience. You know, even on the day when Bill Clinton did the famous 60 Minutes interview, that was taped, by the way, on a Sunday morning in a Ritz-Carlton in Boston. The night before, Clinton and Hillary had done a rally at the YMCA in Manchester. Then they went down to Boston, taped the show. After the taping of the show, Hillary flew back to Arkansas, and Bill Clinton came to Portsmouth and did a town hall meeting at the Frank Jones Center. And C-SPAN was there covering the event, so you can see the footage. And, you know, just the tremendous pressure he must have been under that day. And he just hits it out of the park at this thing. You know, a woman questioner halfway through the thing, you know, gets up to ask a question and says, look, you know, are you going to be admitting adultery? And he's, you know, the crowd boos and he calmly them down and he says, no, listen, you know, it's a fair question. He says, I'd like to ask you to watch 60 Minutes tonight, and that's all I'm going to say. And, you know, it's just, it was just, you know, he confronted the voters directly, and they gave him a second lease on life.
Right. He was the comeback kid. So what do you think his view of New Hampshire voters is?
Well, you know, he clearly does love New Hampshire. I mean, he wrote it in his book, but you can tell by his actions since he left the White House. He had a very nostalgic trip to New Hampshire in his last week as president, in fact, where he went to Dover Dover, where he'd given that famous "Last Dog Dies" speech at the Dover Elks, and he walked Elm Street with Gene Shaheen and others who had been around at the time. Shaheen, by the way, not a supporter of Bill Clinton in 1992. She was a Bob Kerry supporter, and she said at the time, you know, look, she had been with Gary Hart during the 1980s, and she said, been there, done that.
Right.
And this was before the revolutions, but she had heard rumors, she had concerns about him, and she went with Bob Kerry.
Yeah. Well, that was the same year, of course, that George H.W. Bush, the incumbent president, was also running. Early on, the union leader said he's going to waltz into this presidency unless he fell flat on his face. Did not go too smoothly, which you attribute to being caught in between two New Hampshire political dynasties, the Sununus and the Greggs. First, a little background on why the two sides and how it played out on the trail.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. So Hugh Gregg had been governor in New Hampshire for one term back in the 50s as a young man, but continued to be a political power broker here for decades. In 1976, Hugh had been with Ronald Reagan, and he lost. But in 1980, Hugh made a mistake, if you will. He dumped Reagan and went for George H.W. Bush when he was a candidate. Well, Reagan wins New Hampshire, of course, into that famous "I'm paying for this microphone" moment. But that gave Hugh Gregg a relationship with George H.W. Bush that was stronger than anyone else's in New Hampshire, because he had, you know, abandoned Reagan for him. Well, fast forward, you know, 1988, George H.W. Bush wins the New Hampshire primary. The governor at the time, John Sununu, getting a lot of credit for that. The Gregg family feeling a little slighted, like they had been doing a lot of the work over the time. But John H. Sununu became White House Chief of Staff and really was controlling the Bush operation. Now, George H.W. Bush was not expected to get a challenge in 1992. We think of these presidential campaigns lasting a year with candidates coming here. Pat Buchanan showed up 10 weeks before the primary, walked into the legislative office building in Concord, declared his candidacy, and it was a 10-week campaign that very quickly focused on economic misery and whether George H.W. Bush was more concerned about foreign affairs than domestic matters at home.
And, of course, Sununu had been the one who negotiated the tax that came up in the Read My Lips.
That's right. In 1988, H.W. Bush gets elected on the Read My Lips, no new taxes pledge, breaks it, and that became, of course, the albatross politically around his neck that Pat Buchanan hung on him during that campaign.
The same year, Naki Loeb she drafted Pat Buchanan into the race, didn't she?
She did. She ran an editorial saying, "Run, Pat, run," in November, you know, welcoming in. And the union leader supported Buchanan very strongly in 1992. Also, again, in 1996 when Buchanan ran. You know, and so in 92, Buchanan gets 37% of the vote as a protest against George H.W. Bush. Comes back, runs a second time in 96. His market share fell to 28%, but he won the primary because the Republican establishment was splintered. Sound familiar, Virginia? Something similar may be happening this
cycle? Well, I'm actually thinking, you know, he's a fiscal and social conservative, you know, former Nixon staffer, former Reagan staffer. Rhetoric not so unlike the kind of insurgent candidates that we're hearing about today. Do you think Pat Buchanan's time came too late? How do you think he would have fared in this election?
Well, the original Tea Partier was Pat Buchanan. Yeah. You know, people with pitchforks for Pat. You know, he was anti-free trade. He was anti-immigration, legal or otherwise. He was very populist. So, you know, here we are 20 years later, and we see some of the same themes having resonance with at least a quarter of the Republican electorate. Mm-hmm. Now, Buchanan came back a third time and ran again in 2000, but this time his time had passed. He was unable to generate much enthusiasm, ended up quitting the Republican Party and trying to run for as president on the Reform Party ticket. His time had come and gone.
I'm talking with Fergus Cullen. He's former chairman of New Hampshire's Republican Party and author of Granite Steps, Stumbles, Surprises, and Successes Along the New Hampshire Primary Trail. Well, we're on to a new century now, okay? So George W. Bush, he's in a field of 11 candidates, not an exuberant candidate, let's just say. How did New Hampshire voters view that compared to his chief competitors, John McCain and Steve Forbes?
Yeah, so George W. Bush came in as a huge front runner in New Hampshire, and then he blew it, went about New Hampshire all wrong. He skipped two debates in November that year, one at Dartmouth and one at UNH, because he felt he didn't need to do that kind of stuff. And he had been so successful at thinning the field that year that it ended up spelling his own demise, at least in New Hampshire. So there were 11 candidates or something like that. John Kasich was running, dropped out in July. Lamar Alexander was running, dropped out in August. Dan Quayle drops out in September. Elizabeth Dole drops out in October because Bush was cleaning up all the money and they ran out of fumes. So by the time the fall came around, if you weren't excited about George W. Bush, your viable options on the Republican side were let down to two: Steve Forbes, who had run once before and wasn't very charismatic, and John McCain. And what happened was John McCain started consolidating the support of all the dropouts and, of course, doing 114 town hall meetings in New Hampshire, where George W. Bush was sort of blowing voters off here, much more likely to speak to a Chamber of Commerce group than a Republican group, and he ended up paying a huge price for it with the voters.
Which speaks to McCain's talent for retail politics, obviously. But I noticed that year, just before the primary, Thomas Oliphant, writing in the Boston Globe, noted a shift from retail politics to wholesale. What was going on?
Yeah, and that's has only accelerated. You know, the idea that the town hall meetings, it's nice to have 100 people in the audience, but they're really starting to play to the cameras. And all we've seen is that increase. You know, I mentioned how we didn't even have Fox News until the 2000 cycle. In fact, their first debate was the UNH debate. It was George W. Bush's first debate as well in December of 1999. It got the highest ratings ever in the history of that young network in 3 years. And you just see the light bulbs going off in executives' heads saying, hey, this is great.
We found our audience.
We did. And now, of course, they're promoting the debates like it's an NFL football game, and they're getting ratings to match.
Well, McCain, of course, perfected this town hall meeting style, and it had appeal as a real and genuine politician, but wasn't really able to leverage that into the national election. So does that speak to the importance of retail politics in New Hampshire?
I think it still is critical. You know, a candidate, no amount of money here can make up for a candidate who simply can't sell in front of a Rotary group and do a town hall meeting. And this was Steve Forbes' problem, right? I mean, he was, you know, a good conservative, had good ideas, but plenty of money, but he just didn't have any common touch, and he just couldn't sell. And you watch the films of him, you know, speaking to a group, and it's painful to watch how awkward he is. And so no amount of money was able to paper that over. And that's still true today. You know, whether it's Marco Rubio running or John Edwards in recent cycles, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, if they don't have that ability, they're going to fail as candidates. And after New Hampshire, of course, it's all TV green rooms. You know, what can you do in 30 seconds on TV? And you can make up for a lot of deficits in your skill set. But in New Hampshire, the truth is going to come out.
Okay, we're at the close of a heated primary season and reflecting on primaries past with Fergus Cullen. He is former chair of New Hampshire's Republican Party and author of the book Granite Steps: Stumbles, Surprises, and Successes Along the New Hampshire Primary Trail. I couldn't help but think in the general election that year when I saw New Hampshire go blue for Barack Obama, that had to hurt John McCain. Do you think that actual personal connection happens for politicians?
I do. I mean, I was state party chairman at the time, and there was this sense that New Hampshire had a special connection with John McCain, and he did lose it in the general. But, you know, New Hampshire gave him a second chance again. You know, he was flat on his back in July of 2007 and crawled back here. I happened to be live in the audience for one of my favorite moments in the New Hampshire primary in Wolfboro that summer with John McCain. I lived in Wolfboro at the time, and there was a Gold Star mother who lived in the community. Her name is Lynn Savage. And she's, you know, this was when McCain had no staff. You know, and several of us locals recognized Mrs. Savage come into the room and say, oh, you know, there's Mrs. Savage. But John McCain had no idea. You know, she's just another person in the audience. And halfway through, she gets up to ask him a question, and she basically said, you know, Senator McCain, I lost my son in Iraq. Please tell me that he gave his life for a purpose, that his life was not wasted in vain. And would you wear this bracelet in memory of my son? His name was Matthew Stanley. And you can see John McCain again. C-SPAN, I was there live, but C-SPAN also covered this, so the footage is available. You know, he gets a little hitch. He walks up to her. He says, yes, ma'am, I would be honored. He accepts the bracelet. He walks back, asks her, how old was Matthew when he died? And, you know, she responds, 20 or 21. He says, yes, ma'am, I would be honored to wear this bracelet. He takes a deep breath, and he goes on with the town hall meeting. And it was just this unique moment. You know, as I was putting together the book, I came across three incidents in New Hampshire over the years where voters had come up to John McCain and said, I wore a bracelet for you when you were a POW in Vietnam. That must have happened to John McCain much more often than that. So it's just this real poignant human moment, and it happened in Wolfboro.
Right, and a genuine moment.
Yes.
And of course, this is a big question about, you know, the authenticity of politicians, and that brings us to the 2008 election with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton running against each other. Tied in the polls just until the actual primary day. That was the day after Hillary Clinton had her famous crying moment in Portsmouth. What do you think? Decisive moment for real?
I do. So Hillary Clinton, not only does she lose Iowa, she comes in third in Iowa. And that year, the New Hampshire primary was just 5 days later. And she came into New Hampshire, and three things happened that weekend that really strengthened her, especially, I think, with women voters. One was the "you're likable enough" moment in a debate at St. Anselm College. Scott Spradling, well-known to people in New Hampshire, asked a question about likability, and Hillary just hits it out of the park and is interrupted by Barack Obama icily saying, "You're likable enough, Hillary." A real mistake for him. And then on the Monday morning, the day before the primary, Hillary Clinton wakes up, fires her campaign manager by email. Talk about icy. That wasn't public at the time. We found that out later. And then travels to Cafe Espresso on Islington Street in Portsmouth for this round table with allegedly undecided voters. And a woman asks her a deceptively simple question, you know, "How do you do it?" And Mrs. Clinton seems to nearly break down. Her voice certainly wavers. And she says, "You know, it's hard." And she gives this two-minute answer where she appeared to almost be on the verge of tears. And it really humanized her. You know, one of her challenges is that she's been a little bit cold and over the years, a little bit robotic. And that played on a loop for the 24 hours going into that primary. And I think it was part of why she ended up beating Barack Obama here by a couple of points.
I think it really swayed some votes. Well, okay, we can't go through all of these elections, but I'm thinking about, you know, John Kerry. He went to St. Paul's School in Concord, New Hampshire. Mitt Romney had a home on Winnipesaukee. Do you think that actually makes a difference to New Hampshire voters? I mean, they see candidates coming in from all over the country. Does that New Hampshire connection matter?
Well, I think it's been a head start for a lot of candidates, especially if they come out of Massachusetts and the Boston media market. You know, lots of people are getting their TV news from Boston TV stations. They're rooting for Boston sports teams. The Boston Globe has the biggest circulation of any newspaper in New Hampshire. So that gives them a head start if they've been in the news in the Massachusetts media market. But it hasn't been enough in and of itself. But I think people do like that. You know, I like to think that Abraham Lincoln is the one who made the first in the nation primary appearance here back in 1860 when his son Robert was a student at Phillips Exeter Academy. And he, you know, Abraham Lincoln, he gave this speech, Cooper Union address in New York, and "I'll just go up to New Hampshire and visit my son. And oh, by the way, give a couple of speeches." And he spoke in Dover and in Concord and in Exeter on that trip.
All right. So what I'm hearing, Fergus, lessons. Show up. Get the right family on your side. Be personable. Maybe cry. I mean, do these still work? Do they still apply in this, you know, ultra-mediated age when anybody can comment about what's going on in the primary in New Hampshire?
Yeah, I mean, I think the primary does evolve. I mean, I talked about how the advent of cable TV has changed things and, of course, the internet. And we never maybe expected social media. You know, Facebook launched a week after John Kerry won the 2004 primary in a Harvard dorm. And, of course, 8 years later even, when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton ran, Facebook was still not widely adopted. And today now, voters are sort of building their own personal echo chambers. Have you ever unfriended somebody on Facebook because you disagreed with them politically? I mean, lots of people have. And so, you know, it's always evolving and always changing. But fundamentally, a candidate still has to be able to connect with real voters. They can't fake it and they can't make shortcuts.
Fergus, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia.
Fergus Cullen, he is former chair of New Hampshire's Republican Party and author of the book Granite Steps, Stumbles, Surprises, and Successes Along the New Hampshire Primary Trail. There's a link to more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. In 1964, Republican Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. won the New Hampshire primary, though it was Barry Goldwater who eventually won his party's nomination for president. Running against both of them was Margaret Chase Smith, the first woman from a major party to run for president. This profile of Senator Smith comes to us from producers Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries.
There are those who make the contention that no woman should ever dare to aspire to the White House, that this is a man's world, and that it should be kept that way.
My name is Janann Sherman, and I wrote the book No Place for a Woman, A Life of Senator Margaret Chase Smith.
My name is Merton Henry, and in 1964, I worked on the Margaret Chase Smith presidential campaign.
Margaret Chase Smith was born in a little town in central Maine called Skowhegan. Her mother struggled working in the shoe factory, working as a waitress and so forth. So it was not an easy life. And I think that was the basis for a lot of Margaret's ambition, that she didn't want to end up like her mother had. She had better ideas for herself.
She was the first woman ever elected to the Senate in her own right. She was very much a middle-of-the-road Republican who really followed her own instincts on things.
She definitely was seen by 1964 as a hawk.
It does not pay to play footsie with the communists.
She was probably the only woman in 1964 that had the stature to be a serious candidate for president.
It is contended that I should not run for president because the odds are too heavily against me for even the most remote chance of victory.
In January 1964, Margaret Chase Smith was scheduled to make a regular speech to the Women's Press Club.
Third, it is contended that as a woman, I would not have the physical stamina and strength to run. So because of these very impelling reasons against my running, I have decided that I shall.
So that was the opening shot.
Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine, the first woman to announce a serious bid for the White House, who will enter the New Hampshire presidential primary on March 10th.
Go all out for Margaret, the senator from the wonderful state of Maine.
She campaigned in Illinois, she campaigned some in Oregon. She campaigned in small towns before Rotary clubs. She drove both places by car.
She would not accept campaign contributions, so she had no money, no poll workers, no buttons, no bumper stickers. Goldwater and Rockefeller, her opponents, were both millionaires. So I think she decided to take the moral high ground by saying, you don't have to be a millionaire to be president of the United States.
From Washington, D.C., Senator Margaret Chase Smith, Republican of Maine, will face the nation.
She tried to get people to pay attention to her record, what she had done of substance, not the fact that she was a woman. But, of course, she was constantly asked that. I mean, it's the very first thing that people see.
Senator Smith, not all countries have the same attitudes towards women as the United States. How do you think a woman president of the United States would make out in international conferences and those so-called nose-to-nose meetings?
Well, I would remind you that once there was Catherine the Great. I would remind you that there was Queen Victoria. I would also call your attention to Mr. Khrushchev's references to me through the years, when he called me an Amazon warmonger hiding behind a rose.
Well, how do you think you would make out in a kitchen confrontation with Mr. Khrushchev?
Well, I wouldn't care to estimate that. If it was making blueberry muffins, I probably would win.
We are well aware of that, Senator, from having sampled them.
She was always having to walk that tightrope between being strong enough and tough enough to be commander-in-chief, to run a country, but still feminine enough and ladylike enough, because being feminine was absolutely essential. And so she tried to balance it the best way she knew how.
Leave it to the girl where there's a thrill.
She was always meticulously dressed. She was very careful about her appearance and everything.
She would tell Time magazine that nothing clears her mind like vacuuming. or pose with a mixing bowl, or primping in a mirror. That was a favorite. Senator Smith had a campaign song called Leave It to the Girls.
We'll wear perfume and pearls, be diplomatic in pin curls.
The response from the press was not pretty. One of the pundits said that a woman could be president just as long as she didn't act like one. The press never treated her as if she had a realistic shot at it.
Good afternoon. This is the Republican National Convention at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Before this day is out, the nominee of the Republican Party will have been determined.
I am now proud and honored to nominate the senior senator from the great Republican state of Maine, Senator Margaret Chase Smith.
You know, she knew at that point that she was not going to get the nomination, to say the least. Goldwater had the nomination pretty much sewed up.
And there it is. Senator Barry Goldwater is the Republican Party's nominee for the presidency of the United States.
The standard is, if you're the loser and you don't have enough delegates to swing it, well, then you very graciously release your delegates to vote for other candidates. But Senator Smith never released them. And the total of the 27 votes that she got on the floor, she hung on to, denying Barry Goldwater the unanimous vote for the nomination. So she came in second.
The tumult and the shouting has died. Senator Margaret Chase Smith, the lady from Maine, has emerged from her precedent-breaking bid for the presidency with even greater stature and reputation. Let's get around to this. You made some history, lovely lady, in being the first woman ever nominated.
Yes, it's quite a satisfaction today to think about.
Why do it at all? People run because they want to prove a point. They run because they want to make a statement. They run because they've got an oversized ego or something. There are all sorts of reasons that people run for president, even though they may know they have little chance of winning. Her reason was to prove that a woman could be a serious presidential candidate. And she did. She proved it.
Will we see a woman elected president of the United States during our lifetime? Perhaps not so wild a dream. The world is changing rapidly. Politics change with it. Many of the once impossible things have happened. Time alone will tell if a woman will someday break the tradition that only men can hold that office.
And that piece was produced by Joe Richmond and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sarah Gordon was 19 when she got pregnant. The baby's father denied paternity. Given that Sarah has an IQ of 70, her parents came up with a plan to support her and her child. After baby Dana's birth, hospital officials observed that Sarah didn't hold her safely. She watched cartoons as the baby cried and missed feedings because she couldn't read clocks with hands. Massachusetts Child and Family Services stepped in. Within days of her birth, Dana was whisked away and placed with a foster family. And for 2 years, the family battled to get Dana back. The case eventually came to the attention of the Department of Justice. Now, for decades, it was legal to involuntarily sterilize American men and women deemed to be, quote, feeble-minded. Now the rights of the physically and intellectually disabled are protected, opening up questions about whether anyone can judge unequivocally who has a right to raise children. Lisa Miller is with us to consider the many layers of argument in this and similar cases. She's contributing editor to New York Magazine, where she wrote the article about Sarah and her family called Who Knows Best. And Lisa Miller, welcome to Word of Mouth.
I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So that was all it took to remove Dana from her mother's care?
Yeah, I mean, we will never know what exactly happened in the hospital room that day. But there was a combination of things. You know, Sarah allegedly was watching cartoons, as you said, while the baby cried. She seemed, according to some, checked out. She missed a feeding because she can't tell time with a clock with hands. But, you know, her parents and she say that she was doing the best she could, that they had a plan, that her mother was there to help her. and that DCF, the Department of Children and Families in Massachusetts, made a judgment based on her intellectual disability that was biased.
Well, what does constitute an intellectually disabled mother? Is it all based on IQ?
No, it's not. There are various categories that you have to meet. You have to be 2 degrees below, I'm putting this in air quotes, normal in a few categories. So it's not just IQ. And this is actually one of the contentious aspects of this case, which is how do you use an IQ number to correlate with good parenting? You actually can't, right? Mm-hmm. Because we all know people with very high IQs who are not such great parents. So parenting is a complex array of tasks and abilities, and you can't just measure it with a single digit.
But DCF is in a tough spot. Of course, you know, if children come to harm, they're on the firing line. So what are they looking for, or what are they trying to protect the child from? There have been several cases where kids did not fare well with parents who are intellectually disabled.
Right. I mean, their first line call is the safety of the child, right? If they believe the child is in imminent danger, they are within their rights to put the child in a safer place. So already in this Sarah Gordon case, that was contentious, right? Because in the hospital, how much risk is a child actually in with doctors and nurses and family members all around? At the same time, you know, the DCF has to prognosticate, has to say, you know, is this child going to survive her infancy? That's the question before them. And if they feel like she's not, they are within their rights to remove the child from the family.
And there have been cases where people who are intellectually disabled harmed their children?
Yes. I mean, there are 2 cases from 2012. One was a babysitter who had an IQ of 65 who let a child drown in the bathtub because she lost track of time checking Facebook. And another case in which an intellectually disabled mother couldn't interpret the instructions on the back of the can of formula, and so she was mixing the formula into diluted potion, and the child starved. Mm. And she didn't, according to her lawyer, understand the urgency of the situation. So, yeah, I mean, it's possible that a person with an intellectual disability is limited in a way that potentially harms children. It is also possible that a person with an intellectual disability can care for her children. And so the real task before DCF is to make that assessment.
Well, you did find some research on training mothers with intellectual disabilities to become more capable. What'd you find?
Right. So there is a psychologist up in Toronto named Maurice Feldman who has developed this technique both of assessing mothers with intellectual disability and training them. So it's a holistic assessment, right? You don't just do a neuropsych evaluation. You don't just do an IQ test. You look at her abilities within the context of her support system. And you also look at what's called adaptive abilities. That is, to what extent does she understand her limitations and is able to compensate for them? The other thing that Dr. Feldman did over many years was to develop these step-by-step lists. So a very quotidian task like diapering or like cleaning, sterilizing a baby bottle or like treating diaper rash, he broke down into very small incremental steps. And then with hands-on instruction, taught mothers over and over and over how to do this and how to go through the list and check things off. Did I do this? Now did I do this? Now did I do this? And he could raise their abilities to an adequate level. I think one of the questions that the story raises, or I hope it does, is that we have gotten pretty good at figuring out how to teach kids in school who have various kinds of intellectual cognitive disabilities. But in life, we're not so good. And so the supports aren't there for a mother with intellectual disabilities to be taught how to care for her child to an adequate degree.
Well, the article does raise a lot of questions. And what you're bringing up is this idea that people have to be judged on individual cases, I think, and that's something big bureaucracies like DCF are not particularly good at. But how about Sarah? You seem to find her remarkable in many ways.
She's a person who grew up being judged and evaluated her whole life. And to her credit, and to the credit of her family, they developed a very healthy defiance, or a sense that just because the authorities said that she wasn't good enough didn't mean that that was true. So when authorities come in and take her baby away, they don't roll over. They don't assume that the authorities are right. They don't think that the authorities have some kind of truth that they don't have. They say, this has been happening to us our whole life, and we're going to fight this. And I had so much admiration for this family and for their support to advocates. You know, they really fought like crazy to get the baby back.
How smart do you have to be to raise a child? Well, that is a very complicated question that Lisa Miller, our guest, she's a contributing editor to New York Magazine, considered in an article called Who Knows Best? And let's get to that title, Who Knows Best? Now, this is, in many ways, it's very much about paternalism, you know, somebody deciding that you are worth being a mother, you are not, or a parent. And this has a long history in the United States. Tell us a little bit about how these kind of decisions were made in the past.
I mean, there was a Supreme Court decision in 1927. This was about involuntary sterilization of people with intellectual disabilities. The case was Buck versus Bell, and it was a very similar case to this one. A young, single, white woman in her early 20s shows up at the Virginia Institution for the Feeble-Minded. That's what it was called, and she's pregnant. And the state wants to roll out this big program of sterilizing all of the people who are being held in institutions like these. And so Buck becomes their test case. And her lawyers argue before the Supreme Court that her rights, her human rights are being violated, that her constitutional rights are being violated. But she loses. And the much quoted soundbite from that opinion is, three generations of imbeciles is enough. And there was this idea that these people in society were contaminating, had a contaminating effect, and that the state was within its rights to prevent that contamination. And that went on for decades. And so when people started being released from their institutions in the 1970s, late 1960s, this was sort of on the heels of the civil rights movement, nobody quite anticipated what it would mean if they also started doing the things that people do, which is to say, fall in love, or if not fall in love, have sex, or if have sex, conceive. Like, all of these things hadn't been quite thought through. And so social services aren't set up to accommodate the fact that people with an intellectual disability do the things that people do.
And I think you make the point in the article that is it more difficult for somebody who is intellectually disabled rather than someone who's physically disabled in a very apparent way to get people to understand what their life is like and to advocate for themselves?
I think there's no question about that. I think that there's, you know, sort of a hierarchy of disabled in the disabled rights movement. And people with intellectual disabilities and people with mental illness tend to be sort of at the bottom. Still, I mean, you know, the numbers in this National Council on Disabilities report, which was issued in 2012, said that 80% of people with intellectual disabilities have run-ins with child services in which their children are either permanently or temporarily taken away. So that's an incredibly high number.
So all of these things are true, but also, you know, Sarah, while her daughter was in foster care, she's on alert, right? She's trying to act on her best behavior. But on her visits with her daughter, sometimes she would leave her unattended on the changing table. She didn't hold her hand while crossing near a street. I mean, there's part of me that wonders how any parent would do if observed so closely. But also that wonders, well, I mean, if she's got a loving foster mother who can take care of her, is it the right thing to keep her with her natural mother or with somebody who might be able to take different and better care of her?
One of the things that came up for me a lot as I was writing and reporting the story was this question of, you know, I mean, not to be grandiose about it, but what is a mother? What is a parent? And you know, yes, as you say, what parent would withstand the scrutiny of a social worker taking notes and timing you when you're caring for your children? That's unnerving, even for those of us who have good cognitive skills, you know. But also, one of the things that I noticed about the DCF evaluation, right, is that they're evaluating Sarah on her own terms, always. They're not taking into account her family support, her neighborhood support, her community support. The fact that if she were, in fact, living with her daughter and her mother in a house, it would not be Sarah on her own taking care of the child. It would be a community, a clan effort. And so many of us actually parent in that way, whether it's with our spouses or with our own mothers or with our siblings or with our friends or with hired help. We walk away from the baby on the changing table because we are checking on dinner and our husband's in the other room. And we say, honey, like, go look at the baby because I got to go check on dinner. You know, this is what we do as families. And it seems like the way we assess motherhood, at least in this case, was too narrow.
There's so many sides to this. Did you feel torn between Sarah and the state, for a simplistic breakdown?
As I say, I really liked Sarah and her family and her advocates from the outset, but I felt torn about the conceptual dilemma in the story. And I felt extremely empathetic to the foster mother, whom we haven't talked about in this conversation. But, you know, if you're comparing one kind of mother, which is like a clannish, it takes a village kind of mother, to another, which is somebody who really does it all herself, like who cooks and cleans and shops and remembers schedules and can drive and takes the babies back and forth and does the discipline and does the teacher conferences and all of that stuff. You know, the foster mother was apparently that kind of person. And now I add the caveat that I don't know because I wasn't there with her when she was raising the child. But she was brokenhearted at the fact that she was given this child to raise. And then in the end, the biological claim wins out and the foster mother is devastated. You know, I don't know that the state can be in the business of deciding who's a better parent. I think the state is in the business of protecting children, and it needs to make those assessments because, you know, we are all deficient as parents in all kinds of ways. And that's one of the things I kept thinking about, you know, when I was writing the story, is in what ways am I deficient? What are my adaptive abilities? Who really does take care of my child when I'm at work? How many people are charged with her safety and health? I think these are all questions that we have to raise honestly and not have some vision of motherhood that's some kind of perfect solo agent in the world. And at the same time, you know, really take seriously the fact that sometimes a child is not safe in her own home.
Lisa Miller, thank you for your reporting and thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Lisa Miller, she's a contributing editor at New York Magazine, where she wrote the article Who Knows Best, which questions how smart a parent has to be to raise a child. We welcome you to read the article. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for listening today, and there's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, and you'll never miss a trick if you subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or on Stitcher. And if you like the podcast, please rate it or pass it along to a friend. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow too, here on NHPR.